Awesome. Well, I want to welcome us back to Salt and Pepper. Today, we have our podcast guest with us, which is Dr. R. Danny Scott. She's an assistant professor at Minnesota State University, Mankato, leading the way in diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. With a background in speech language pathology and a PhD in general psychology, Dr. Danny's research centers on empowering culturally diverse students. She's also deeply committed to teaching culturally responsiveness and serves incarcerated women through an innovative program. As a trailblazer in DEI, cultural humility, and social justice, Dr. R. Danny Scott's insights are sure to leave a lasting impact on our listeners. Let's dive into this enlightening conversation today with Dr. Danny. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
We're so glad you're here with us today.
I'm glad to be here. I've been so excited about this.
Well, we're excited about the whole theme of this podcast, racism as a public health crisis, because it spans so many different areas, looking specifically just at health as a singular item, but rather a more comprehensive area. And the work that you do is transformative and certainly critical to this topic. So maybe you could just start out by talking to us a little bit about systemic racism in relationship to speech, hearing, and rehabilitative services, but also looking at the impact on equitable outcomes for racial and ethnic diversity groups.
Yeah. So my field is called speech language pathology. And I think within the name, we can kind of raise a little eyebrow to get started with the conversation. The first word being pathology, meaning essentially we were founded using the medical model of disability, where you are looking for some sort of disorder, pathology related to communication. But in order for there to be a conversation about a deviation from typical communication, we have to ask what is usually considered typical. And in every other sector, it is usually white, male, middle class, able-bodied, monolingual, English speaking, all of those things. And so inherently, because of that model and because of our foundation, I think whiteness is really baked into our profession. And a lot of the work that we're doing when it comes to health equity, dismantling racism, we have to acknowledge that history. I do believe that whiteness is baked in our profession, and it's really hard to kind of parse things apart, I guess you could say. But in regard to communication as a whole, so a speech language pathologist is going to diagnose, assess, treat, hopefully prevent communication disorders. And so your communication disorder could be in the area of speech, language, also swallowing. Speech has more to do with the sounds that you produce. Language has more to do with how you're understanding information and how you're able to express yourself. But then everyone is not a verbal communicator. So we also support people who are nonverbal. Perhaps they may have an AAC device that they use to communicate, or they use pictures to communicate. Many people use sign language to communicate. Language is kind of like, language and speech are big pieces, I think, that really can kind of give an example of what I talk about whiteness being baked into the profession. So let's say there's a lovely Black child in your class and someone has said that this child needs speech therapy. Usually it is because there is, There could be a lack of understanding when it comes to Black language, African-American English. So let's say this child is saying, close the door. They're saying, they don't really say the TH sound. Maybe they substitute a D because that is permissible in African-American English. So if I was not knowledgeable about Black language, I could over-diagnose or misdiagnose a Black child. And so many Black and Brown children are that we see in special education. A lot of times there is this issue with, are we being culturally responsive when it comes to the diagnosis and the treatment? I will say that with the way that our, with the equity barriers we have in the profession, that is the reason why we see the demographics in our professional makeup. So our professional makeup needs a lot of work in terms of diversity. I am a Black speech therapist, but only 3.6% of speech language pathologists are Black. So yeah, our field is about 92% white, mostly women. And so we don't have a lot of men. We don't have a lot. There isn't really data on non-binary folks in our field. So that's a problem. And then we definitely have a need for people of color, people who are bilingual. So, yeah, this question is kind of hard to answer, I guess, because I see so many things being deep into the field. But I think in order for us to even address the health equity issues that we are seeing with our clients, we have to think about our foundation and think about what are some of those barriers inherently in the field.
You know, one of the things I think of, Dr. Danny, is there is a TED Talk from Jamila Lyscott, and she talks about being a trilingual orator, right? And she talks about how she speaks her native tongue, which is Patois, because she's Jamaican. She talks about, because she's from the hood, she speaks Ebonics. And then she talks about, I speak English, right? So I'm trilingual.
Trilingual.
We talk about the D versus the T and the cultural aspect of language. How do you, when we think about this concept of racism as a public health crisis, how do you see that in your work presenting itself? Like, what are some of the real world examples that you see in terms of lived language as compared to the language that people perceive a child should be using or a person should be using?
Yeah, I mean, there's this thing that we talk about in our field called standard language ideology, which basically is this belief that there is a standard language, and that standard language is white mainstream English. And so anyone who deviates from that, whether they are an African-American English speaker or another non-mainstream English dialect, are accented speakers, it is always viewed as less than this standard of comparison. And so I think that's very, I think it's deeply rooted in not only what we're seeing in clients as far as misdiagnosis, but even the perception. So many times language is perceived as intelligence, and that in itself is so, I think, a lot of times related to the implicit bias, the racism that we're seeing. So an African-American English speaker is more likely to be perceived as not intelligent. So maybe there can be some implicit bias in our healthcare field in regard to, well, I'm not going to tell them that. They probably don't know what that means. I'm not going to recommend that, you know? And so the stigma surrounding non-mainstream English dialect speakers and also accented speakers and bilingual speakers who, where maybe Spanish is their native language and Spanish influences the way that they speak English, but they are speaking more than one language, which is a cognitive strength, a social strength. And most people in the world speak more than one language. In fact, bilingualism is more normal than monolingualism, right? But because we have this stand, because we have these standards, I think, you know, implicit bias could play a role in that. And then, of course, the way that we diagnose, I think a lot of times we do need to improve in regard to being culturally responsive and making sure our assessments are responding to the people that we are serving.
How do you think, as I listen to you, I think about, certainly in education across the board, there are barriers to parental involvement or parents trusting the system or seeking assistance. And I would think in your area of expertise, you might see an even greater distrust or hesitancy to seek support for a BIPOC student who actually needed it, who wasn't misdiagnosed. And I'm just wondering your thoughts about that.
Yeah. So you bring up a good point, because with the information I'm saying, misdiagnosis includes the underdiagnosis and overdiagnosis. And in fact, if you look at the literature in this area when it comes, so we kind of, a term that we use is cultural and linguistic diversity. So if I'm talking about, you know, just someone who is not the standard, so probably not a white student, probably a student who speaks more than one language or dialect speaker, I could go on and on. So someone who is culturally and linguistically diverse, we have data that shows that there is misdiagnosis, but it could be underdiagnosis or overdiagnosis. So when I'm talking to my students about this, I say overdiagnosis looks like when you are thinking that because you don't understand their culture and their language, you think that everything that they are doing is associated with a disorder. And so you are putting them in special ed, or you are giving them a diagnosis at their private speech clinic, and they don't need that diagnosis. So that would be over. But underdiagnosis kind of looks like, oh, you know, they talk like a rapper, but that's fine. They always, you know, having those where I'm not even gonna check. So if someone is an African-American English speaker, oh, they're fine, because that's just how they talk. Instead of truly understanding African-American English and saying, is this characteristic of the language of their community? Or is this showing me they actually struggle learning the language of their community? So when I worked in the schools, and I worked with mostly Black and brown kids, kids who look just like me. And so I am very intuitive to what African-American English sounds like, but I also had to tune my ear to hearing Black kids who struggled with even speaking African-American English. So that showed me that, oh, they're not learning the language of their community. So that is a disorder. But I think we can kind of struggle with that. I'm not going to say it's the easiest thing. It does take a lot of, you know, learning and also humbling yourself to learning. But yeah, that's definitely what I see, a combination.
Awesome, Dr. Danny. You know, I wonder, in your work, if you can describe, so when I first started to talk to you about speech language pathology, I really didn't have a context for the actual setting in which your job takes place. So when you're in the schools or when you're in the community working to really hone in on what issues we have within the communities in terms of speech and language, can you tell me about like how SLPs interact with diverse communities? Is it in the schools? Is it in community-based settings? Where do you do your work?
Yeah. So, you know, we have a lot of different settings where we may work in. My experience was working in the schools. So I worked in elementary schools, but you can work in the schools. You can work in Head Starts, daycares. That's kind of like our child population. You could also work with babies in the NICU who are having difficulty swallowing and feeding. Let's see, toddler. You can go into the home. So there's early interventions. You can work with the family in their home. Also pre-K's, Head Starts. And then for adults, I mean, it could be you can also work with kids in a hospital, but you can work in a hospital. A lot of skilled nursing facilities where older adults might need support with cognition and language and swallowing. That's most of them. I would say that I don't see a lot of community-based work. I think we are very clinical, you know, coming from that medical model. We have even dragged the medical model into the schools with the work that we're doing too. And we should be embracing more of the social model of disability, but we're kind of all over the place. I would love to see more community-based work. And, you know, I have the privilege of doing some of that at our, at MSU, because I want our diverse students to be able to work with children who look like them. And so that involves us going into the community and not being little FBI agents who are looking for diagnoses. It means we're going in the community to build these relationships. And then after we build relationships for a substantial amount of time in the community, then maybe we can start talking about doing some assessments and really supporting in a more like technical way. But I think community-based, it can be because there can be mistrust with the medical system for a lot of our Black and Brown communities. It is not wise to do community-based services unless you are going to be culturally humble and culturally responsive in the way that you do it. So, but I would love to see more of that.
You know, one moment, Kelly. You shared with me, Dr. Danny, a document that talked about the features of African-American English, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I want to make sure our listeners get a snapshot of is, as we're talking about how language presents itself, right? So if we're giving that example of African-American English and listening for those distinctions, do you have some examples from your work of things that people can look out for, or commonalities or common trends that you've seen for how African-American language presents itself as compared to white centered language, if that makes any sense?
Well, I don't like to compare African-American English to white mainstream English, because I think that's problematic in itself. We're always comparing. And let things stand alone and let things be authentic and be what they are. But I just love African-American English, not because I'm a speaker, but I'm very proud. But the more I formally learn about African-American English, I notice how complex it is. So pragmatically speaking, speech language pathologists, we work on communication as a whole. So one area of communication would be like your social skills. And I think that's an area that people don't really think about. So even African-American English, there are some things that we do socially that are deeply rooted in West African culture. Even, you know, like call and response. There are certain things that we do that are very much rooted in that culture. In regard to like certain sounds, so that would be phonology, our phonological aspects of African-American language. Definitely, you don't have to have like a hard G at the end of your words. So you can say going instead of going, running instead of running. And then grammar is kind of the one that I think people most associate with intellect. Like, oh, you have bad grammar. This is poor grammar. So then you're not academically competent when you're an African-American English speaker. And so that's completely not true. But an example would be like zero copula, which means you don't have to use is. We don't have to say she is going to the store. She going to the store. And then my favorite one that I use all the time, habitual be. I love a good habitual be. So we don't have to say, so, you know, if you ask me, did I do this podcast? I can say, girl, I been did that podcast. You didn't hear it. And so, you know, using, I be looking so cute on Saturdays, not Fridays when I'm at work. I mean, just the B and the way like our B marks timing. I love that. So there's a lot of different, there's so many different structures, but one thing I want our listeners to know is African-American English, whether you call it a dialect or its own language, it is a symbol of our history in this country in regard to transatlantic slave trade. So it is something that we have carried with us when we were speaking all of these different tribal languages, and we were forced not to speak those languages, and we were forced not to learn how to read. And so we were developing this English where it's really English on top of West African thinking patterns. And so here we have this African-American language, African-American English, which is a signal of our survival and the way that we kept moving, and we found a way to communicate with one another, and it continues to show up today. And so, you know, there are so many different features, and I mean, I don't even know them all, even though I use some of them. So I'm still learning. I'm still learning about it.
No, I think that's important, because we're talking about this concept of racism as a public health crisis. Language is something that really feeds racist behavior, right? In some ways, it's been used as this rationale for not seeing people Black people, BIPOC people, for not seeing them as human, right? And I think of human in a H-U-E-M-A-N kind of way, thinking of the different hues that make us who we are. Mm-hmm. It's been a form of erasure, right? You don't have this. So there, when I think about microaggressions and the messages they send, there's that you're so articulate, you know, and I think even red flagging my own experience of this week, I was reading about, I believe, I can't even think of her name, but it's a young woman who saw potentially a toddler on the side of the road, and she went after this toddler and disappeared. And as she's gone, the news, when you look at how Black women are described in the media, there's an undertone of trying to substantiate that this person is deserving of being searched for by validating she's very classy, she speaks like this. And it makes no sense why in this time we're talking about how this woman speaks, but it's, we want you to know that she's a respectable woman, right? So there's always been this misconception that if you speak African-American English, then that makes you less deserving of respect and more deserving of racism. And so I think about as we're highlighting language, that's what it really drives home for me. Microaggressions and the messages they send can largely be rooted in language, right? And how we interpret or understand or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm. You know, I ponder the definition of anti-Blackness being not being able to recognize the humanity in Black people. And one of the most beautiful things about humanity is our ability to communicate. And I'm not just speaking verbally, but in every way, because everyone is not a verbal communicator, but in every way, we are communicators. And so, you know, in our field, to not be able to see the humanity and the richness of diversity that we have with our language and the way that we speak is sad, because it's not seeing the humanity that someone has inside of them. And so, yeah, completely relating to what you're saying there. It's resonating.
Thank you. You know, one of the things I think that we can segue into, again, this podcast has been sponsored by Blue Cross Blue Shield. And it's really a conversation for us to think about how corporations and organizations can really shed light, but help us to highlight this situation or this issue of racism as a public health crisis. So in your world as a speech language pathologist, one of the things that really sticks out to me is your responsibility for building up the next class of diverse speech language pathologists and the role that you take and the responsibility for reaching back. Can you speak a little bit about your inspiration for that responsibility, or what it is that makes you intrinsically interested in seeing more Black and brown faces in SLPs?
You know, I have never had a responsibility that I have taken more seriously. Now, I suppose when I become a mother, I'll take that very seriously, but I do not have kids. So this is like, you know, this is the baby right now in this season of my life. But I think the inspiration is not only knowing my own experience, but so many people alongside of me that I have, the Black and brown people that I'm with in community with, who have struggled to find their way in this profession. And it starts with the admissions. It starts with being admitted, because you have to have a graduate degree to become a speech language pathologist. So beyond undergrad, even if you have barriers getting into undergrad, there are so many barriers for people of color getting into grad school in general. And then on top of the fact that most people don't even know what a speech language pathologist does. So if you found a way to discover this field and then you have a desire to do it, there can be barriers along the way. You know, a lot of our programs are very much dependent on high GPA and high GRE scores to get into grad school, and not really using that holistic admissions approach that says we don't need the GRE to tell us if someone can be successful in graduate school. We're going to look at these letters of recommendation. We're going to look at their statement of purpose, and we are going to make pathways. And so I have the privilege of doing that. But I think the inspiration just comes from, I can't even begin to tell you all of the stories I have heard from people We even have a test, the Praxis, which is a standardized assessment that you have to take in order to get your licensure. And, you know, Black and Brown people struggling with that test. And I almost feel kind of bad, like, yeah, you can keep going. We're going to have this review. When really I want to blow the test up. I don't think we need to be doing that. So it feels so, you know, I have like this cognitive dissonance experience trying to encourage people. And then I'm like, but I wish we didn't have these barriers. In the first place. So yeah, it's challenging, but I take my role as an assistant professor. I take that so seriously because I know that we can be gatekeepers in this field. And if we aren't thinking about how to recruit and how to retain, meaning not only getting people into graduate school, but is it a climate to where they can thrive? Is it a climate that they can leave empowered and say, I want to be in this profession. So I take that so seriously, and I'm grateful to have that in my role here at MSU.
I think it's super interesting too, because when you look across health professions, you'll see a similar demographic in many of those professions, whether that's dental hygiene or nursing. And yet we know that there are communities that are yearning for people who look like them to provide much needed healthcare and other kinds of assistance, you know. And yet, as you said, higher ed really has become a gatekeeper that is protective of white people. So, you know, it begs the question, do I need to have a 3.9 GPA to be able to do X, or could I have a 3.0 and be able to do the same profession? Mm-hmm. And you know, I won't name the profession necessarily, but you can apply, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, then I think about Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson and her most recent comments that she really what she wrote in opposition to the decision on affirmative action, you know, and how she talked about our country has never been colorblind. When we start thinking about race-based preferences in America, until we start looking now at college. I mean, I'm not doing her what she said justice, but she was talking about the intergenerational transmission of inequality, you know, that's plaguing us. And we have the ability. One of the things that we've talked about already in the first podcast is that systemic change. Like, how do we leverage what we individually can do, but look more broadly at systemic change, which is what you're talking about. Like, how can I bring more opportunity and really what's necessary in your profession and for those people who critically need some help from somebody who looks like them and who understands them and who is culturally aware. And it's like, what can we do to really break down those systemic barriers?
Oh, and there's so many. I mean, you know, I think recruitment for students needs to go hand in hand with recruitment for faculty. Mm-hmm. Students will come when they know, oh, she's there, I'm going to be okay. Mm-hmm. He's there, or they are there, and I know I'm going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And so that is huge. And I think, oh my gosh, there's so many barriers for even faculty of color. I'll be here all day, but there's so many barriers for faculty of color and students of color. But then...
And when you're one of the only, the burden is on you.
The burden is on you.
Yeah.
And, you know, people ask me that, and it is burdensome in the sense of, I think people underestimate the mental and emotional heaviness that is associated with this. Is all of your work relates to diversity. I'm sure you understand. But a lot of times faculty of color are siloed into DEI work when that is not their area. They're, right. You know, in our field, even in our field, I actually have an area, a research area that is not diversity, equity, inclusion. Like, I got a whole PhD in psychology and I study like relationships and counseling. And I actually do have other things, but this is the big one. And this is the one I'm pushed in, but I accept that because that is passionate to me. But I know so many people who they want to highlight their area of expertise of their personal color, but they feel like, you know, they have to do the DI because they're the only one to do it. And that is burdensome. Like that mm-hmm. feeling of, well, if I don't do it, who's going to do it? And the weight of your entire race and is depending on you. That is heavy to have.
Yeah. You gotta be there for the students. You gotta be there to represent on committees. Mm-hmm. You have to push mm-hmm. the issues and the initiatives to make change. And by the way, you have a discipline, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, you have a content area that you're an expert on, right? And that you want to be recognized as an expert on and you want to develop. So it's mm-hmm. it's an undue disjustice for you as an individual. And really the responsibility needs to be on those leaders who should be courageous leaders mm-hmm. to make sweeping change, often those that are white that need to do it.
And if the weight, even when the weight is on the people of color, the biggest problem is that the work that we're doing is not valued.
Right.
Like, you know, very much, oh, you do so much service. Well, what are you doing all day? A lot of service, a lot of.
And yet it's not going toward you becoming a full professor.
Exactly. And so the work that we're doing, that's kind of like the issue with the faculty. You'll get the faculty in, but then they don't get tenure. Well, why? Because the work, they are doing work, but the work that is asked of them is different from the work that is asked of mm-hmm. other faculty members. And then the work that you ask them to do is not valuable.
Right.
Is not valued right. by the university. And so that in itself can make it just be like, this is, do I want to be a part of this?
You know, I was thinking about, and I loaded this question just to make sure we get to it, like specific health disparities. So we think about from the K-12 aspect, how those children are either going to be overdiagnosed, they're going to go into special education, they're going to be diagnosed into emotionally behavioral cognitive, right? We're looking at how they're routed. What implications do you see for those same students in terms of their trajectory when they try to go to college and they have a SLP diagnosis that either follows them in a way where it impedes upon their success, or what are some trends that you might've experienced?
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was working in the schools, I would always present to my kids and the families that speech therapy is not a life sentence. Now I love a good speech therapy sesh because I'm a speech therapist, but baby, I don't want to see you here every year. So the role is, I mean, literally you are supposed to set IEP goals so they can make progress, so that they can learn strategies, so they can carry those strategies over and be successful in the classroom. So yes, there are some disorder areas, if you will, where you might need speech therapy for a bit longer to learn those strategies, especially if your area is a little more severe. Like let's say you have autism, but it's maybe moderate to severe, and you know, you're going to need support with your vocational skills, all those things. Okay, I can see that maybe you could get speech therapy all the way to high school, but a kid working on, because you got a list, and we've been working on this since first grade, I want to see you succeed so you can get off of this caseload. So I think, unfortunately, with special ed, if you don't have those special educator innovators that are trying to create IEPs that don't look the same every year and really trying to get kids out into the general ed classroom. Well, I know you have these struggles with behavior, but you love social studies. So I'm going to make sure you get to go to that social studies class. If you don't have that, then a lot of times kids can just continue and continue in special education. And that's an ethical concern for so many reasons, because it shows in like lower expectations of kids who are in special ed. Like, wait, what do you mean you're going to college? The only expectation I have of you is just to graduate, maybe. So, you know, the lowered expectations, I think, can kind of be an invisible label. You know, a lot of parents talk about, I don't want my kid to have a label. And I absolutely understand that. But I think there are, even in addition to that, there can be those invisible labels of having lower expectations. So, you know, challenging service providers to have those conversations with parents, like, what do you want for your child? What are your expectations? Oh, you want them to go to college? What college are we going to go to? Okay, let's talk about how we're going to get there. And having those conversations as early as possible in keeping those high expectations of your children. But when it comes to college, it can be hard, you know, and you can seek accommodations at a university so that you can get through college, but it shouldn't be a requirement to put in accommodations for someone to accommodate you. So, you know.
Exactly. You know, when you talk about accommodations, one of the things that I think of, especially in terms of racism, but your role as an SLP, is how sometimes children and students or adults even, you ask the wrong question and you get the wrong answer. And it's not that you're asking the wrong question. It's someone on the receiving end not taking the time and attention, giving it the time and attention for them to figure out what is this person trying to ask. In your role, I wonder, for your unique industry of speech health and rehab services, what do you see as your role in dismantling systemic racism and promoting health equity for the populations that you serve?
Yeah, I mean, I think my role and the role of many professionals like me who are in my field of speech language pathology is really to be, I've been saying this a lot lately, like to be justice seekers. And we can be justice seekers if we first don't acknowledge the injustices in our field and then in our own sectors finding ways to do that. So I was having a conversation with students yesterday. They're taking this class called Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in Speech Language Pathology. I teach the first half on education settings, and the second half is taught by another colleague on medical settings. And they brought up a topic that I didn't even think of. So one of the things SLPs do, we can work on swallowing. So people who have swallowing disorders, and we support them, maybe give them strategies, things of that nature. And, you know, recommending a diet. So thinking about someone who maybe they had a stroke and then they have to be on like a mechanical soft diet or thin liquids and all that stuff, right? And so we recommend food. But what happens when you have someone sitting in front of you and they're coming from a lower SES background? Maybe they have WIC or they have food stamps and you're recommending these foods that they can eat and none of the foods are on that list. So what are they supposed to do? And I think that's just one example. But in our field, I think we have to really start thinking about the lived experience of the people sitting in front of us and thinking about the barriers that they must be experiencing. So with like cultural humility, which is a framework in healthcare that has to do with constantly self-reflecting and also holding institutions accountable, I think that is a great way that we can move forward in dismantling systemic inequity. So back to that conversation about the person who maybe couldn't afford that food that you recommended. Are you really self-reflecting on your own biases? Did you create goals based on your socioeconomic status or based on the client's socioeconomic status? What are your blind spots? If you are an SLP that is middle to upper class, what are your blind spots? Okay, reflecting on that. And then also building partnerships. So if you happen to work in a hospital setting where a lot of the people are maybe lower SES and maybe it is common to have people on food stamps. So how are you going to create programming? Because you know there's a barrier. So what are you going to do to create programming so when that comes up, you're being supportive to your clientele? And then holding institutions accountable, just thinking about any funding options, anything that can support the clients in front of you. So a lot of advocacy that some professionals may feel is outside of their job, but it's not. Advocacy is a part of our job. And so really embracing that, I think, could be a great start. Advocacy and cultural humility when it comes to just dismantling the systemic racism we're seeing.
You know, I like that you highlighted SNAP and WIC and some of our Minnesota-based programs. You know, as this is sponsored by Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is largely focused on Minnesota healthcare and dismantling those systems within Minnesota, I think it's important to really shed light that we have an infrastructure, right? Programs like SNAP, but there still are these disparities with regard to what foods those families can access. Mm-hmm. Farmers markets, fresh groceries, grocery delivery services, as we're thinking about those disparities. And as we talked about a little bit about, you know, some of the disparities in speech language, I think about, again, how you talked about how research shows that Black children may not be more likely to experience the language difficulties, but they're more likely to be overdiagnosed, right? And when you're not thinking about the context in which you live or that you digest these communities, it makes me wonder, are there any specific training programs, right? So when we're specifically talking about, you can't teach some of this stuff, right? You can't teach a person to understand what it's like to come from the hood, if you will, what it's like to come from a community where the majority live in low socioeconomic status. Mm-hmm. Feel that there are any specific like cultural competency or anti-racism training programs that can be implemented to help develop speech, hearing, and rehab services to address racism as a public health crisis.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, as a speech language pathologist, we have so many avenues where we can develop our education, our professional education. And we do have requirements like most healthcare professionals do, you know, so we're under this board. If you have a certification called CCC, Certification of Clinical Competency, then you are certified under the American Speech Language Hearing Association. And under that association, we have these wonderful multicultural constituency groups where you can be a part of no matter what your ethnicity is. And there are lots of professional development opportunities. I'm a member of the National Black Association of Speech, Language, and Hearing, and we have a conference every year where any SLP can join and get professional development. And we are actually hosting our first Cultural Humility Conference this year. And so with that, we are having about 6 hours of professional education on the topic of cultural humility. And then we also are having a cultural humility ambassador program so that people can have more of a cohort feel to dig deeper into the concept of cultural humility. So that's just an example of some professional opportunities. And then state organizations as well. So in Minnesota, there's the Minnesota Speech Language Hearing Association, who also has a conference every year. This past year, I did a talk on like anti-oppressive clinical supervision. And so there can be some topics there. We have lots of virtual opportunities to gain professional development in those areas as well. So I would say there are definitely opportunities, but I don't know.
You know, as you introduced cultural humility, what just got me excited is I was in Florida and I was sitting in my hotel lobby and I met a woman, and her name is Dr. Jan Marie Garcia. And she is.
You met her?
Yes. That's where I learned the term. Listen, that's where I learned the term. I'm sitting in the lobby. And so, And this is the conversation we have. We talk about the work that I do. It was when I took Maya to Toby in Orlando, and she's sitting in the lobby and we start talking about locks and natural hair. She goes into how she's out of San Diego. And in 1998, she coined this term, cultural humility. And I'm like, where have I heard it? I heard it from the source. And so, I remember when I heard it from her and how she articulated, how she explained the heart of what it's supposed to do. And I'm so happy you've introduced that into our conversation. Can you share just a little bit about how you feel cultural humility, what role that plays in this whole dialogue and conversation that we're having? Mm. What is cultural humility and where do we get some?
Yeah. So, and I love that you asked me this. I actually teach an undergrad class called Culture Humility. So that article is like, I stumbled upon it when I was writing my dissertation. It has been life-changing. So that article is really the token of what we're using to start that conversation on cultural humility, because they made this definition and it is rooted in healthcare. So I'll explain the definition a little bit again, and then I'll talk about, enacting it. So with cultural humility being a lifelong commitment to learning. So cultural competency is fine, but that is, I'm acquiring knowledge and skill sets. But we know that with the richness and diversity, you could never possibly acquire every skill set and every knowledge, checking off that you know something for the people that you will encounter. And so one of the things I talk to my students about is really learning your own cultural identity and self-reflecting on any biases you could potentially have because of your cultural identities, but also thinking about your beliefs and your value systems and learning your clients' beliefs and value systems. So you center those in therapy. Cultural humility is also about building mutually beneficial partnerships. And it's about holding institutions accountable. And so the research shows that cultural humility facilitates therapeutic relationships. So whether this is a counseling relationship, a speech pathology relationship, social workers, you name it, there's this therapeutic relationship that says, I must collaborate with my client and I must have an emotional bond with them, meaning I must build rapport with them, or we will not see treatment success. And cultural humility facilitates therapeutic relationships. So when you have cultural humility, you are increasing the likelihoods of treatment success. So cultural humility is essential to the work that we're doing. And even rapport building could be so healing when it comes to the mistrust that many people of color have in the medical system and in some in educational systems, you know. And so really centering that cultural humility piece so that we can build those relationships and build those partnerships with communities, and we can start to see changes that we want to see.
Oh, I'm muted. When you say cultural humility, one of the things, like if I pull up a chart that it shares, is that cultural competence, which is what we're also used to talking about, is looking at how you build an understanding of diverse cultures, right? So that you can provide those services. But cultural humility makes you look at yourself. It makes you humble yourself and say, how do I encourage my own personal reflection and growth in this area? And it's a much more introspective process, right? And so as we're talking about taking ownership, right? We're always agency versus ownership. When we're talking about taking ownership for your role and responsibility for helping to really eradicate racism, right? Eradicate racism as this public health crisis, understanding things like how you have to begin with self, begin looking within yourself and working your way outward and saying, what blinders that I have? What are the barriers that I may be presenting? But as you highlighted in the beginning of our conversation, in what ways is my positionality a barrier or a gatekeeper to myself? And how can I be vigilant, not for the public shaming of the situation for what it is, but more so the progressive nature for how can we move beyond? How can I use my positionality, but also my power? And if we talk about Kelly, if you permit it, you promote it. We're all about leveraging your privilege. How can I leverage that for something that really may not have a direct impact on me?
And so many people, you know, when I talk to my students and when we finally get to the acknowledgement of a student, like I love when the student has an aha moment, like I do have privilege. I have white privilege. I'm like, okay. I'm not shaming you because you have privilege. It's about, we all have privilege. You know, we talk about in our cultural humility class, we talk about intersectionality. Please know that all of us have marginalized identities and privileged identities. So your privileged identity might be that you're white, but guess what? my privileged identity is that I am PhD educated. Mm-hmm. So I have one too, and I have a marginalized one here, and then we share the same. Exactly. So acknowledging what that is and reflecting to the extent of saying, okay, I have this privilege, but because I have this privilege, someone will be more than likely, will be more likely to listen to a white person say it than, you know, me. I'm up here talking about, oh, racism, systemic racism. You know, for a white person to talk to a white audience about systemic racism, that will hit different. So right. How are you using your privilege? How are you thinking about allyship in a way that, okay, I want to enact this, but I have to acknowledge my privilege, and that's going to humble me in this journey to allyship, mm-hmm. because I know I have these blind spots.
Exactly. You know, we have just a couple more minutes, I think, to really bring home the conversation. So we talked a little bit about allyship and community support. I think I am a fan of accompliship, right? Like in the trenches. Mm-hmm. And I think that as we're talking about leverage privilege, when I think of like the ally versus the accomplice, I think the energy that an accomplice brings is where you leverage that privilege in spite of realizing the outcome may not have a direct impact on you. It may not even have an indirect impact, positive or otherwise, right? And so as we're thinking about that, can you share just some final words, I think, about the role of allyship or accompliceship in speech-language pathology as it relates to eradicating racism, right, as this public health crisis, if you will?
Mm-hmm. You know, allyship, it just kind of, the word that I'm thinking of that's like on my heart right now is like taking action. And I think many times when you are on this journey in regard to, let me acknowledge racism exists. Okay, I'm past that. Let me acknowledge how I'm being complicit. You are going to have feelings. Sometimes your feelings are feelings of guilt, like, wow, I feel so bad now. Or one of them is going to be anger. This is not my fault. So you're saying we're the blame, da 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 da. So whatever it is, it's emotion. To be understood, that is natural. But the sad part about emotion is that it sometimes debilitates people from acting. And so I think with allyship, that acknowledgement and moving through whatever feelings you are experiencing to a place of action. And there are lots of opportunities you have to act. Maybe you miss one because you were scared. Okay, take the next one. Another opportunity is going to come. So the action piece is so big. And then it also makes me think about, you know, Ibram Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, and the conversation that not racist literally means nothing because it's passive. So you can sit and say you're not racist all day, but if you're not anti-racist, if you're not actively moving, then are you really, what does that really mean? And so I think allyship has to be active in every way. And sometimes people don't know how to act, but I hope that not the fear of like, am I going to do something wrong? Am I going to make this mistake? Doesn't like debilitate people from using whatever they have in their sphere and making a difference and making a change.
Well, I think you kind of also answered if there was any like last advice or recommendations that you might have for our listeners who want to take action, right? You talked about taking action and contributing to how we address racism as a public health crisis. But do you have any last burning thing that you really wish to leave a person with or leave our listeners with regarding the field of speech language pathology or the state of racism in America, right? Or internationally, nationally, just the idea that racism still exists in today's world? Is there anything burning last that you'd love to share?
Racism exists and it literally will not go away just because we don't talk about it. Just because we try to make decisions that are race neutral, which there's no such thing as race neutral. People that created racism want things to be race neutral. It's beyond me. But it's not going to go away. And it's also not going to go away just by talking about it, because I think now it's like there's a lot of conversations. And even me, when people are asking, like, what should I do? And I'm like, well, listen to these podcasts, read these books. But please know that's the first step. Mm-hmm. Like, education is the first step, right? But as you're starting to learn some terminology and wrap some language around some different things, you want to start taking action. How do you take action? You build partnerships within communities. You build relationships with people and become a true ally. I think it's hard for people to even imagine allyship with someone they wouldn't befriend, or someone that they have even no reference for someone's lived experience in their own sphere. So then how do you jump up and go to a protest and be an ally? That don't even make sense. Mm-hmm. We're skipping a lot of steps. Exactly. You know what I mean? So I do know it's a journey. There are steps, but the action is the most important part. Don't get stuck on the emotion. Don't get stuck on, I don't know everything and I need to learn. Okay. As you learn, how can you build a partnership with someone? You know, and there are so many ways you can do that in your workplace. So many places you could start that. It can be small steps. I don't think it has to be, you know, huge steps, but small steps of what we can do.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today and for sharing all of these wise words. We hope that all of these podcasts, but we also know that yours will inspire others to be aspirational about their responsibility, about what they can do. Getting our arms around the breadth of what racial inequity is and how it's a public health crisis means we need so many hands to be thinking in so many areas to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And many hands make light work, but it's not light work. Mm-hmm. So that's our goal as we move forward, is just to inspire others. And we know that you did today. So we appreciate you contributing.
Thank you for having me. We talked about so many things.
You know, I think before we wrap up this amazing episode, we want to make sure we extend a special shout out to our incredible series presenting sponsor, Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota. With their support, we can continue bringing you essential conversation like today's, impacting communities far and wide, thereby and large, who made this podcast possible for us, who presented the opportunity for us to speak with you today and for us to have this wonderful conversation to share with our listeners about speech language pathology and the role it plays in helping to eradicate racism as a public health crisis, not just for some, but for all communities here in Minnesota.